The Tom Woods Show, episode 1355.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, my away carry-on is everything I look for in a suitcase. It's lightweight, strong. It's got a really smooth glide through the airport. It's got a built-in combination lock, a compression system for overpackers like me, and a laundry bag to boot. Get $20 off a suitcase when you go to awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS during checkout. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here, talking about Einstein today. And I got this idea from the supporting listeners group. I'd asked, what are some topics I could cover just on my own? And as I told you yesterday, I got some good episodes coming up with some guests. I think one of them will be Friday, one of them will be Monday. May have a guest before then, but the ones I promised are coming Friday and Monday. But anyway, somebody recommended the essay that you may have heard of by Albert Einstein himself in Monthly Review, which was a socialist publication, in its very first issue in May 1949, and it was called Why Socialism? So as you, again, may know, those were Einstein's sympathies. And I thought, well, why not look at it? Somebody recommended that I talk about it. Of course, I'm going to link to the article at tomwoods.com/1355 if you'd like to read it. What I'm going to do is comment on it a bit, and then I'm going to play for you an excerpt of my Ron Paul curriculum talk on the socialist calculation problem, because Einstein really does walk into that trap. He actually is advocating a kind of socialism that immediately runs into the brick wall of the socialist calculation problem. He seems completely unaware of it. He does not address it in any way or seem to understand that it requires attention. He just glosses over it, and I'm not going to let Einstein get away with that. So here we go. I actually remember years and years and years and years ago, I was at a conference, and Hans Hoppe was speaking, and of course, he has a German accent, and he said at one point, well, you don't have to be Einstein to see this. And then later it was my talk, and somebody asked me a question. And as part of my answer, I said, well, you know, look, you don't have to be Einstein to see. And everybody knew I was slightly mocking Hans. I got a big laugh out of that. I was a little scared doing that, but I got away with it. Anyway, I think it's interesting. The first few paragraphs of the essay consist of Einstein pleading with you that it's all right that he doesn't have any particular background in this area, that he should be entitled to express his opinion anyway. And it's so crazy because never would, if I were to come up to him and say, well, I think I'd like to talk about relativity, but I don't really have any background in it, but it's just such an important topic that you can't just leave it to the experts. He would say, what is the matter with you, right? But if it's economics, well, you know, this is all very indeterminate and anybody can chime in on it. So one thing he does say is that there are methodological differences between, for example, astronomy and economics. And he says, scientists in both fields attempt to discover laws of general acceptability for a circumscribed group of phenomena in order to make the interconnection of these phenomena as clearly understandable as possible. And he says, but methodological differences do exist. All right, so at least he gets that. That's good. And then he makes one point that's not completely offbeat, and this is part of, at least a small part, of Ludwig von Mises' argument about why economics has to be approached differently from the hard sciences. Einstein says, the discovery of general laws in the field of economics is made difficult by the circumstance that observed economic phenomena are often affected by many factors which are very hard to evaluate separately. Now, much more clearly, Mises explains this point by saying that you can't run a controlled experiment. I mean, obviously, that's what Einstein should be saying here. You can't run a controlled experiment in the social sciences. You can't isolate one factor. Leave everything the same, change one factor, then run the experiment again, and then get a sense of what the influence of that factor was. You can't do that. And moreover, first of all, you can't run experiments. Secondly, there's so many factors going on at once in the economy that if we, let's say, fiddle with a wage somewhere, fiddle with a price somewhere, there's still so many things going on in the background that it's hard to know what's causing what. So for instance, we could raise the minimum wage to, you know, $20 an hour. And let's say that employment stays robust. Well, that could also be because elsewhere in the economy, there was a sudden uptick in labor productivity. and that offset the disemployment effects of the minimum wage. So the point is, you wouldn't be able to just raise the minimum wage, there are no disemployment effects, and say, well, look, see, apparently it has no consequences. Because there, as Einstein says, there are many factors going on at once, and it's hard to disentangle them. That's true, but what he's still kind of caught in the idea that all sciences must be like the hard sciences. So he speaks of the observable economic facts and such laws as we can derive from them. So again, he thinks we're going to stare at sheafs of documents and hope that laws somehow jump off the pages. But for precisely the reason he says earlier, you can't do that because there are many factors at work and you can't run experiments on them. You can't isolate them. So this approach is fruitless. So he's got this all wrong. And in the show notes, I'll link to the episode I did with Jeff Herbner where we asked the question, is Austrian economics unscientific? Because it does not follow this kind of approach. It's that it's a different kind of study. And it involves human beings with free will, so there are no constants involved. So there are a lot of reasons that it can't be studied in the same way. And this was a point that Mises often made. There's a different way to study man in society than there is to study inanimate projectiles, for instance. So I'll try and remember. I don't want to write that down. Forget about relying on my middle-aged memory here. Then he says, look, socialism is directed toward a social ethical end. Science, however, cannot create ends. All right, so here he's just departing from the idea of economics as being value-free. He says that socialism has a social ethical end. Now, he is correct in one sense, that sometimes people get so carried away with science, they think it answers every possible question. But if you go around saying all men are created equal, that's not a scientific statement, yet you may believe it. It's a metaphysical proposition. You may believe it, you may have good reason for believing it, but science is going to tell you the exact opposite. Everything observable about people shows how different they are. The way they look, the different skills they have, whatever. I mean, their height, their speed, their, you know, how readily they absorb knowledge, whatever, their personalities. Everything science can measure is going to tell you human beings are completely different. So all men are created equal is a metaphysical proposition that almost everybody believes at some level. What they mean by it may differ, but at some level, or people will say, well, everybody should be treated equally before the law. Okay, again, perfectly good reason to believe that. That is not something you could test in a test tube, but yet we don't say that it's not a valuable statement and that it's not defensible. It's just not defensible through the scientific method. That's okay. Not all knowledge comes through the scientific method. So he, you know, by saying that science can't tell us what our ends should be, well, that's a valuable point to make. I mean, science can tell you how to reach your end, but it can't tell you which end you should have. So it can tell you how to, build a nuclear missile, but it can't tell you whether you ought to use it. Okay, so that's fair enough. But to me, the idea that you would look to economics to tell you what you should do and what you shouldn't do is a category mistake, because economics, like other sciences, seeks to describe, not prescribe. This is what's going to happen if you do X. That's why it's there. Now, with regard to what constitutes a science or not, that's a separate question. That's probably covered in my conversation with Jeff Herbner. But it really just has to do, in this case, we call economics a science because it's looking for cause and effect explanations. It's not the case that something is or is not a science because it involves test tubes and lab coats. That's not fundamentally what it's all about. But anyway, Einstein says, for these reasons, we should be on our guard not to overestimate science and scientific methods when it is a question of human problems, and we should not assume that experts are the only ones who have a right to express themselves on questions affecting the organization of society. So now, I agree with that to the extent that a lot of self-appointed experts are hopeless. And a lot of times we've tended to give a lot of, extra respect. We put on a pedestal an expert intellectual class that really doesn't deserve to be placed there. If that were his point, I would say yes. For a lot of those people, they're bozos and you're perfectly entitled to your opinion as against theirs. But if we were talking about a room full of Jeff Herbiner, Bob Murphy, and Joe Salerno, and really great economists, then I wouldn't say, well, my opinion is just as good as theirs and just as informed as theirs, and because then that would just be pure anti-intellectualism. I should go back for a second because he says, nowhere have we really overcome what Thorsten Veblen called the predatory phase of human development. He says, the observable economic facts belong to that phase, and even such laws as we can derive from them are not applicable to other phases. All right, well, that's just assertion. That's all that is. Then he says, since the real purpose of socialism is precisely to overcome and advance beyond the predatory phase of human development, economic science in its present state can throw little light on the socialist society of the future. Okay, so apparently the socialist society of the future is going to transform mankind completely such that we can't even describe what the society would look like or the structure of human action itself. All right, well, that should just dismiss it out of hand. Then it's completely unscientific. It's just a fantasy. You get back to us when human civilization has been adequately transformed, in your view, and then we'll talk. So what's the deal here? So then we keep reading. I'm still waiting to get to economics. We don't get to that till after the second half of the article. He says that, and you know what's interesting about this? I really urge you to read it, is how commonplace the observations are. I mean, here's Einstein willing to take counterintuitive positions in science. Counterintuitive in the sense that the man on the street wouldn't have anticipated them. But when it comes to economics and social theory, he is so pedestrian. He's got nothing to contribute that hasn't been said a million times before by smarter people. So it's this kind of thing of, man has to live in society. No. Does he really? He has to live in society? Really? And that's supposed to be a great insight. And of course, he, as with all these thinkers, just very, very, in a very subtle way, just conflates society and the state. Well, man needs to live in society. That's why we need the boot on your head. Well, but those are two different things, aren't they? Society and an organized center of violence, these are two different things. Does society require that institution? Well, we can talk about that, but you can't just go ahead and not only just assume that it requires it, but act as if really society and the state are kind of the same, such that if I say man has to live in society, therefore the state can use all kinds of coercive apparatus, one doesn't really follow from the other. So he says, the abstract concept society means to the individual human being the sum total of his direct and indirect relations to his contemporaries and to all the people of earlier generations. The individual is able to think, feel, strive, and work by himself, but he depends so much on society in his physical, intellectual, and emotional existence that it is impossible to think of him or to understand him outside the framework of society. It is society which provides man with food, clothing, a home, the tools of work, language, the forms of thought, and most of the content of thought. His life is made possible through the labor and the accomplishments of the many millions, past and present, who are all hidden behind the small word society. All right, well, I mean, most of that's unobjectionable, but the small word society is too small to encompass what's really going on here. We should be talking about the division of labor. And Einstein later admits that the division of labor is here to stay and basically a good thing. So let's skip ahead to where, because he's got all this pomposity for a while till we finally get to, okay, well, what is it actually that you're calling for? He says, if we ask ourselves how the structure of society and the cultural attitude of man should be changed in order to make human life as satisfying as possible, we should constantly be conscious of the fact that there are certain conditions which we are unable to modify. As mentioned before, the biological nature of man is for all practical purposes not subject to change. Furthermore, technological and demographic developments of the last few centuries have created conditions which are here to stay. In relatively densely settled populations, with the goods which are indispensable to their continued existence, an extreme division of labor and a highly centralized productive apparatus are absolutely necessary. All right, well, that's something. That's something. When you look at the early Marxists, there's nothing but hatred for the division of labor. And then he says, the time, which looking back seems so idyllic, is gone forever when individuals or relatively small groups could be completely self-sufficient. What seems idyllic to you about that, right? Would you like to go to the dentist in those conditions? There's nothing idyllic about that. Then he says, it is only a slight exaggeration to say that mankind constitutes, even now, a planetary community of production and consumption. All right. Yeah, international division of labor. Not a moment to pause at the wonder of that, that there is an international division of labor that has occurred without any central direction. Not one moment of pause to acknowledge that there's something awe-inspiring about that. Nothing at all. Now we get to this. I have now reached the point where I may indicate briefly what to me constitutes the essence of the crisis of our time. It concerns the relationship of the individual to society. The individual has become more conscious than ever of his dependence upon society. So again, society. All right, society, yeah. I mean, I can't make all the stuff I need, so I need to be part of society. I like companionship, so I want to be part of society. I enjoy social interaction, so I, you know, society, no problem. It's the leap he makes from society to the fist. That's the problem. And then he says, but he does not experience this dependence, meaning on society, as a positive asset, as an organic tie, as a protective force, but rather as a threat to his natural rights or even to his economic existence. I absolutely guarantee you that nobody thinks of society as a threat to his natural rights or to his economic existence. Nobody thinks that way. They may feel that way about the state, but the state is something different. And Einstein will not make that distinction. And then he says, that man's position in society is such that the egotistical drives of his makeup are constantly being accentuated, while his social drives, which are by nature weaker, progressively deteriorate. And then man can find meaning in life, short and perilous as it is, only through devoting himself to society. Okay. All right, now, here we go. Here we go with the economics, finally. We're on page, out of five pages, on page four, we actually get to economics. And you know, why should we expect much economics? We've already been told that we're not going to really know how this is going to work until human beings are transformed. So don't worry. Trust us. We're going to all be transformed through some mysterious process. And then everything's going to be fine. Okay. That doesn't seem like a crazy thing to demand of me. He says, the economic anarchy of capitalist society. So there, it's just what is that? A cliche. The economic anarchy of capitalist society. Like, that hasn't been said a million times before. What do we need Einstein to tell us this for? The economic anarchy of capitalist society as it exists today is, in my opinion, the real source of the evil. We see before us a huge community of producers, the members of which are unceasingly striving to deprive each other of the fruits of their collective labor. So instead of looking at the International Division of Labor and saying, this is the greatest cooperative enterprise in the history of the world, you've got people all over the world speaking all different languages, pursuing all different lines of work, and yet the output that they produce is complementary to the output of other producers, which is then used and combined by still other producers to produce something for a retail market without anyone really being in charge of the entire process. It just happens. And of course, it's a cooperative system. I mean, I don't want one of my suppliers to go out of business. I want him to do well. It would be disruptive for me for him to go out of business. I want these people to succeed. But for him to talk about the economic anarchy of capitalist society, well, here is where tomorrow I'm going to talk to you about the socialist calculation problem. Some of you have heard it before, but I think my explanation might help you understand it even better. And others, especially you newbies out there, you really are going to want to hear this because it really, really is important. Because what you find with the economic calculation argument is that the economic anarchy is not on the capitalist side. It's on the socialist side. That there's anarchy in capitalism in the trivial sense that there's no single person with a bullhorn. I mean, Einstein absolutely believes in, as we'll see in a minute, the bullhorn theory of society. There's a guy with a bullhorn, and that's what makes things happen. If you don't have that, then it's an anarchy of production. But it's not anarchy, because it's anarchy in that sense, but not anarchy in the colloquial sense. When people use anarchy, they mostly mean it in the colloquial sense of chaos and disorder. And that, you know, that's unfortunate that it carries that connotation. But that's what people mean colloquially by anarchy, usually. They don't mean a system where private firms provide security. They generally mean, well, this is going to be anarchy. They mean chaos. But there's no chaos in the free market because the price system, which emerges spontaneously, and again, I'll talk about that tomorrow too, The price system, which emerges spontaneously, is what guides producers to produce what they produce. And when they calculate profit and loss, they are guided to continue in what they're doing, expand what they're doing, scale back on what they're doing, scale back on particular parts of what they're doing, and maybe scale up in other parts, or to cease business activity altogether. They're not doing this on the basis of tea leaves or intuition or tarot cards. They're doing this on the basis of what they know by observing prices, anticipating price spreads in the future, and looking at their bottom line and calculating their costs and revenues and subtracting one from the other and seeing if they've made a profit or not. And that is how they decide what to do, and they decide what to produce and how much and where to produce. For example, how do I know maybe it would be better for me to produce something 10 miles away from where I want to sell it, as opposed to producing it right here where I want to sell it? Because maybe land is cheaper 10 miles away, and yes, my transportation cost would be greater, but maybe the land is so much cheaper that it still makes sense for me to be located out there. Now, if I didn't have prices of the means of production, if I didn't have a price for land or for the transportation costs, there's no way I could compare the two options. So I would naturally say, well, I want whatever's most convenient for me. I'm going to be located right here. But what's convenient for you? I mean, here's Einstein claiming to care about society. But without the guidance of prices and the means of production, and as we'll see tomorrow, under socialism of the Einsteinian sort, you don't have any, there is no way to decide what's best both for you and for society, because you have nothing guiding you. You would just say, well, if this is where I want to sell my stuff, this is where I should build my building, right here. But what the price system is trying to tell you is, you know what, that land is so valuable and so demanded by people in other lines of production that are more urgently demanded by consumers, that it would be really better for society if you could just locate your plant just 10 miles out of town. And that way, yeah, there's nobody with a bullhorn, because first of all, the guy with the bullhorn also wouldn't have prices, so he would also not know what to tell me. He could boss me around, but if he doesn't have any prices and he can't calculate profit and loss because he has no prices of the means of production, he can't know what my costs are, how would he even be able to tell me what to do? He wouldn't even be able to know to say, you need to be 10 miles out there. He wouldn't even know that. So even if we had the guy with the bullhorn, what's the guy with the bullhorn going to tell me if he does not have prices to go on? So the price then tells me that if I'm going to coordinate my activities with the billions of other economic actors in the world, I better do the following things. I better set up over here. I better make sure I use this kind of resource instead of that one, because that one's really, really urgently demanded elsewhere. And if I were to use it, I would be lowering the value output of the economy, because goods that consumers demand more urgently need that input more urgently than I need it. So prices kind of steer me away from using that input. All these many, just this huge array of decisions now is made clearer, and I'm integrating my decisions with those of others and coordinating with those of others. Even though I'm not doing so explicitly, the price system in effect forces me to do this. And this is how capitalism is the most socially aware system. Because if you had socialism and you had no prices for the means of production, you could not make all these decisions that help, in effect, coordinate the whole structure of production, making sure that this one gets what this one needs. And not just what they need, but consumers have shown they want this good, and they want this thing produced, and they want it urgently. And therefore, that thing should be able to get access to the means of production. And we make sure that they get allocated in such a way that consumer preferences are optimally satisfied with the least possible waste. All right, I got more to say about Einstein. Let's take a quick break. I told you I was out of town last week, and of course, you know what that means. I was the king of the airport. Of course. How was I the king of the airport? Because I had my Away carry-on that I cannot live without. And in fact, you know, my daughter Regina has been appearing in some of my sponsored messages, and she said she could easily do an Away carry-on ad because I'm constantly talking to my kids about how great it is. I couldn't live without it. And it makes such a great gift. Most people would not think to buy something like this for themselves, but it's going to make their lives so much more comfortable. Everybody needs a suitcase. I use the Away carry-on, but they have two carry-on sizes. They have full-blown suitcases. They're super durable and super lightweight. They've got a compression system that helps overpackers like me. They got these four 360-degree spinner wheels. I can take that suitcase, put it on the floor of the airport, and just gently push it, and it just glides, you know, almost frictionless. It's beautiful. It's got a TSA-approved combination lock built into the top of the bag to prevent theft, free shipping on any Away order within the lower 48 states. And remember, listening to The Tom Woods Show benefits you yet again, because for $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS during checkout. That's $20 off a suitcase at awaytravel.com/woods when you use promo code WOODS during checkout. All right, let's get back to Einstein here. That's a funny thing to say, isn't it? I'm reviewing Einstein. So then we get basically the Marxist idea that what the worker receives is not determined by the real value of the goods he produces, but by his minimum needs, so basically the iron law of wages, and by the capitalist requirements for labor power in relation to the number of workers competing for jobs, whatever that means. Now, there are a lot of things we can say about this, a lot. I mean, we can talk about how the different factors that go into producing a consumer good, how they're valued, how they wind up having prices attached to them. And we just see that labor is just one of those. I mean, where does steel get its price from? Where do all the inputs get their prices from? And they basically get it from the reverse imputation, the consumer demand for the final good, and that gets imputed to all the various inputs that go into the production of that final good. But what I instead want to talk about is, let's take a look here. Yes, the idea that the worker gets his wages, that his wages are determined by his minimum needs, like whatever is minimally necessary to keep him alive is what he'll get paid. All right, so let's first just examine that empirically. Is that really how it has worked out? Even in 1949, when Einstein was writing that, is that really how it works out? Today, you have, I think it's roughly 1% of the population that earns the minimum wage. But if that were true, I mean, wouldn't everybody earn the minimum wage? Why would it be such a small percentage earning the minimum wage if wages are determined by the absolute minimum that you'd have to pay someone? I mean, let's imagine this. I like this example from George Reisman. Let's suppose you had a car. You lived in New York City and you had a car. And you just found that having a car in New York City is such a pain in the neck. It's such a pain in the neck, you'd be willing to sell it for like a buck just to get it off your hands. In fact, you would be willing to pay somebody. Let's say that you just really hated having a car. You'd be willing to pay somebody to drive that thing off. You know, if that's what it came to, you'd be willing to do that. Now, does the fact that you would be willing to actually take a negative price for the car, you would pay somebody else to take it, does that have anything to do with determining what the price that you get for that car is? No, of course not. That has nothing to do with the price you wind up getting. It has to do with the offers you get. But people come up to you and they say, well, I'll offer you this and I'll offer you that and I'll offer you that. And you don't go up to them and say, well, you know, by the way, in a pinch, I would have paid you to take the car. Why would you do that? Right? So it has nothing to do with it. So that's an extremely good insight that we all know we've been in situations where we've got some product, you know, maybe it's something at a garage sale. I'm like, oh, you're doing me a favor by taking this old couch away. You know, but you don't, that's not what determines the price you wind up getting for the couch. Your sense of despair about the couch has nothing to do with it. It has to do with how many people come and make bids. That's the thing. So likewise with a worker's wage, there are other capitalists who would be very glad, in the same way that if somebody were making superhuman profits with steel, well, other people would then go into whatever industry it is and they would bid away steel and they would bid up the price of steel so as to get a share of those profits for themselves. They would do that in any line of work, not because they love steel and not because they love labor, but because they love profits. And there are untapped profits here. If you're getting abnormal profits by underpricing something and not paying the factor commensurately with what it's producing for you, then somebody else will jump in because they perceive a profit opportunity and they'll bid those resources away. And that's why not everybody earns, you know, 50 cents an hour or something. And incidentally, I said the other day, I gave an example of a butler with a tray. And I said, the way productivity increases can help even a butler with a tray is as follows. I said that if a butler, look, what possible advances in productivity are going to affect the productivity of a butler? I said, once you invent the tray, as Reisman says, that's pretty much it. There are no further productivity increases for a butler. So how can productivity increases help him? And the answer is indirectly, because productivity increases elsewhere in the economy can yield a greater abundance of goods, which puts downward pressure on the price of those goods relative to wages, and therefore increase his real income. But the other way that I might have also said it is that if labor becomes more productive in other lines, and therefore labor in other lines is able now to command a higher wage, well, that's going to tend to pull butlers out of butlerdom, because they're going to see those higher wages and get pulled away. In order to keep people as butlers, you're now going to have to offer them more. Even though their productivity has not increased, their opportunities have, because now other labor is worth more. And if you're going to keep labor in your house when the rest of the economy is saying, look, this labor is really lucrative over here, you've got to be willing to pay more. And that's another way that wages rise on the market. Then Einstein says, under existing conditions, private capitalists inevitably control, directly or indirectly, the main sources of information. It is thus, he says, press, radio, education. It is thus extremely difficult, and indeed in most cases quite impossible, for the individual citizen to come to objective conclusions and to make intelligent use of his political rights. How about that education? I mean, the private school system was even less developed when Einstein was writing than it is now. And this is typical left-wing hysteria and just living on another planet. Education is directly or indirectly in private capitalist hands? That's crazy. Now, press and radio are different. But even there, what's he proposing to substitute? The socialist state? I mean, if socialism is going to own all the means of production, then how do I make sure I can get a printing press? Maybe the printing press only goes to people who support socialism. I mean, you think that's going to be a society where you're going to be able to get to the truth? Right now, as we've seen, we've gotten closer and closer to finding the truth the more our news sources have become decentralized in the exact opposite direction of socialism. All right, let's get to the finally. I mean, there's a lot of other things that he says, but in a socialist economy, he says the means of production are owned by society itself and are utilized in a planned fashion. See what I mean? It's all cliches, right? Owned by society itself. Well, what does that mean? Every single person in society is making allocation decisions on a daily basis? Of course not. What that means is a small sliver of society is going to make the decisions and everybody else is going to have to deal with them. On a daily basis, there's no way, even just practically, everybody in society could be making those decisions. So that doesn't really answer. That just pushes the problem back. And again, he has no idea that there even is a calculation problem. And so, as I say, tomorrow I'll be giving you the whole spiel about that. He also guarantees a livelihood to every man, woman, and child. Child? Well, speak for yourself. Capitalism is busy doing away with child labor. And then he says that a planned economy adjusts production to the needs of the community. Well, as I hinted today, without the price system, there's no way to know how to adjust things for the needs of the community. There's no way to evaluate different possible courses of action to know which one satisfies the community better than another one. Even if you were deranged and deluded enough to think you knew all the priorities of the community, as if there were such a thing, as opposed to a bunch of individual priorities, even if you were deluded enough to think you knew them, you still couldn't carry out your plan because you wouldn't know which course of action was the best one that allowed for the satisfaction of the maximum possible plans. So again, tomorrow, we'll get back to that. And this is the education of the individual would attempt to develop in him a sense of responsibility for his fellow men in place of the glorification of power and success in our present society. Right, because a lot of socialist societies did that, right? None of the apparatchiks in the Soviet regime in any way glorified power or success, right? They were all thinking about self-sacrifice. So in other words, you people aren't good enough for my system, so we're gonna herd you together and we're going to ram some ideas down your throats. Then maybe this thing that I can't describe how it'll work will work. How anyone gave this a moment of his time is beyond me. But then he finally admits there could be some problems. It is necessary to remember that a planned economy is not yet socialism. A planned economy as such may be accompanied by the complete enslavement of the individual. Huh, well, you don't say. The achievement of socialism requires the solution of some extremely difficult socio-political problems. So again, no None of these problems are the socialist calculation problem. He doesn't even seem aware of it. He says, how is it possible, in view of the far-reaching centralization of political and economic power, to prevent bureaucracy from becoming all-powerful and overweening? Well, indeed. How can the rights of the individual be protected and therewith a democratic counterweight to the power of bureaucracy be assured? Well, they never really did answer that question because they never cared to. That was not their priority. If you read the life and the history of Lenin in Russia, and you think to yourself, this man was motivated by a desire to protect the rights of the individual, then I don't know what to say to you. That problem was not solved because it wasn't viewed as a problem. That's why. So that's Einstein talking about socialism. He starts off by pleading with you that his uninformed opinion that consists of nothing but cliches that I could find pretty much anywhere is something that really you should spend your time listening to. Well, spend your time more listening to refutations of it. That's a little bit of a refutation, but the key devastating stake through the heart refutation comes tomorrow. All right, now, before I go, how about this? For any German speakers out there, one of the only German-speaking anarcho-capitalist podcasts is Alex Anarcho. Alex, just like the name, A-L-E-X, alexanarcho.net. And it covers all the topics you'd expect to be covered, but in the German language. And they could certainly use a dose of what we have to say over there. So I urge you to check that out, those of you who are German speakers, alexanarcho.net. You're going to love it. I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/1355, as the listener website mentioned for today. And remember, if you want to start a website or a blog or anything like that, like a podcast that has a website, then make sure you get your hosting through my link and you'll get all kinds of great bonuses, including a barrage of fresh targeted traffic, which instead of tumbleweeds going by when you announce the launch of your site, you'll actually get some traffic, plus other great bonuses. Find out the details about all this at tomwoods.com/publicity. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.